This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Redistricting is on the mind of State Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck. The Salt Lake City Democrats' House District includes The Avenues, a neighborhood that's split up between Utah Congressman Rob Bishop and Jim Matheson, even if neighborhoods are supposed to be kept together as much as possible in the redistricting process. The lawmaker is also the co-chair of the House Ethics Committee, which has certainly been in the news for the past couple of years. She joins me now in the studio to talk about redistricting, ethics, open records, and other issues this morning. Representative Chavez-Houck, it's always good to have you here.
Thanks again for the invitation, Jeff.
Listeners, you can join us on the air as well. Give us a call at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, Representative Chavez-Houck, there's another redistricting meeting tonight in Lehi, the first public meeting. From what you've observed of the process so far, the few meetings that have been held and the way the committees were put together, do you think it's going transparently or not so much?
I think there are a variety of different processes that are going on. This always happens every 10 years where you have what may be seen as a more public process, which is the committee convening and the opportunities that they offer for the public to provide input. And then I see some more informal networks going on, which always occur. And it's just part and parcel of the nature of redistricting and of politics. And those are, you know, conversations that the individual caucuses have. And it's also an opportunity, I think, for the public to convene in groups of interests of constituencies of voters. I think that the Utah Citizens Council and the Represent Me group are great examples of how people can participate in this process and maybe give it more depth and more rigor. I believe that the committee itself provides just one level of transparency and opportunity for people to provide their concerns and weigh in. But I always encourage my constituents, because I've had a number of them approach me on, you know, how can we make an impact? How can we let our voice be heard? Especially since the proportion of membership on the committee is definitely aligned to political representation in both chambers. And, you know, what I tell them is that there's the opportunity of letters to the editor, op-eds, talk about those concerns of keeping communities of common interest together. Talk about how you have felt that you may have or may have not been represented in the past 10 years. And also talk about what potential lies ahead of us. You know, we're looking at a decade of planning. We're having to think about what will the community look like over the next 10 years. So the transparency is there, but I think that the public has to often look for the opportunities to see what's going on and to provide that input.
Do you think there are backroom meetings going on? You suggested there were more informal discussions. Were you hinting at that?
Yeah, I think that I don't necessarily call them backroom meetings. I think that they're discussions among constituencies, and obviously caucuses are such a constituency. But I think that's why I wanted to bring the example of the citizen groups, and I feel that they need to articulate as much voice and power as possibly caucus discussions or party discussions. I mean, it's just nature of the beast of redistricting and apportionment that that those discussions will happen at a party level as well as a caucus level and as a chamber level. So it's those discussions that I know that are going on. People are looking there. Those members that are those legislative members that are also members of the committee are starting to look at ways of drawing maps. And that's part of what they have the opportunity to do in terms of working with legislative staff. I'm looking forward to seeing what the new software looks like for the public to participate. And I'm anxious to see that come online so that the public really can start being a part of that process in the map drawing process. But I know that the council, the Utah Citizens Council, and a number of other groups are already starting to do that on their own. And I find that very promising.
I'm certain there are a number of listeners out there, you could say it's cynical or being jaded, that would think that, you know, the software, you could draw your own maps all you like, you could submit them, you can show up at the meetings, in the end it might not have any difference whatsoever. Would you say that's partially true, entirely true? What do you think?
I think that what happened with the Grandma Bill, HB 477, is an example of what can happen when the public takes the reins of something that's happening in the public sphere, in the public process sphere. And while, you know, maps are starting to be discussed and there are constituencies that are convening to look at what redistricting might look like, I don't think I'm necessarily that jaded. I know that there's many that are, but I think that keeping the committee's feet to the fire and by articulating a concern if they feel that the process isn't fair, like they've done with Grandma, with HB 477, I think there's a way of being preemptive. And I know that a lot of people were upset when HB 477 passed, because they were saying, you know, we didn't have an opportunity to weigh in. This happened very quickly. And I guess what I would say to folks that are feeling somewhat cynical is, okay, here's an opportunity. Here's a process that you could basically take the reins from if you wanted to, if you used that same level of potential energy that you used in fighting and for the repeal of Grandma to the extent of supporting your voice and your concern as to how this redistricting process moves forward. So, you know, I've talked to constituents about listening to those meetings, the redistricting meetings online. I've got the schedule myself right here in terms of the upcoming public meetings, and I'm really encouraging people to take part of the process, maybe or maybe not. I mean, I can't say as to how much influence will have on the final outcome of maps and plans. But I will say this much: if people don't voice their concern, that what ends up happening is people say, you know, my colleagues say, well, you know, there were only 40 people at that meeting. Obviously, people didn't care. And I was already seeing that in terms of input from some people on how many people were listening to the Grandma 477 working group. So it's a matter of just participating in the process, I think.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, and my guest is State Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck, Salt Lake City Democrat. I used to live in the avenues myself, and I recall the lower avenues. Mm-hmm. I recall that I was on the very eastern edge of Rob Bishop's district. If I had lived literally the next block over, I would have been in Jim Matheson's district. When you talk to people, how much do they really care about that issue?
I think it depends on how active the constituent is. I have heard from a number of constituents about their concerns of what's going to happen with this next process and what the congressional districts will look like. That's part of why I was so adamant about including, to the greatest extent possible, trying to find a way to keep communities of common interest together. Mm-hmm. I ran a bill this last session to establish legislative rules tying that as one of those principles by which the redistricting committee would at least consider. Maybe it wouldn't be an absolute definitive principle, but something that they would take into consideration as they're drawing the different congressional districts and apportioning individuals within those districts. There's been a lot of discussion in the committee about diversity within a congressional district and competitiveness, and how having a diverse ideological spectrum within a congressional district provides for a more moderate voice in representation. And I can appreciate that argument to a certain extent, except in this case, I believe what has happened, if you dilute it too much and you try too hard to make those districts competitive, at least at a congressional level, when you're representing so many individuals, there is going to be a group and sometimes a sizable minority whose voice is just completely quashed. And I think that if you were to have a conversation with the more progressive members of my district that live in and Congressman Bishop's outlying extreme boundaries, they would say that they don't feel necessarily heard. And it is interesting when you see community of common interest like the avenues, where having that demarcation line being H Street is just really perplexing, and I think very frustrating for a lot of my constituents who feel that they're not being represented well by him.
Listeners, you can join us on the air, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Were you hoping to be on this redistricting committee yourself, and is there a big difference, do you think, between being on it and not being on it in terms of the final outcome?
I think it's important for all of us that are members of the legislature to take a leadership role in voicing our constituents' concerns as we move through this process, especially, as I mentioned, since it's going to impact representation for a decade. Now, whether that means that we need to be on the committee or not, I don't necessarily believe that you have to be on the committee to hold a leadership role or to exhibit leadership in presenting your constituents' concerns. I have some experience having served on the National Conference of State Legislatures Redistricting and Elections Committee, because issues of participatory democracy are something that, you know, I really feel strongly about. A lot of the bills that I run relate to that. So I've had some opportunity to learn about redistricting in other states, how it plays a part in encouraging individuals to stay engaged as voters, and how it might prohibit them or inhibit them, depending on how their districts are drawn and whether they feel they have a opportunity to really vote for the person that they believe they want to represent them. But I think I can do that from the sidelines. It allows me to maybe have a little bit more of an individual perspective aligned to my constituencies, versus, you know, having to devote a lot of time to the committee work itself. But know that it's something that I'm keeping really close tabs on, and it's something that that I'm trying to do from the perspective of how will this best represent the state in general over the next 10 years.
Representative Chavez-Huck, let's talk about one of your other roles, and that is as co-chair of the House Ethics Committee, the only committee in the House where Democrats and Republicans have equal representation. Talk to me about what you were hoping to do with this role during the 2011 legislative session and how successful that was.
Well, there are a number of bills that I ran that I was hoping to get a little bit more speed under, and it didn't quite happen. Oftentimes with these types of pieces of legislation, it's just going to take a number of years to move them forward. And part of the challenge is when there's a lot of turnover, when you have taken some time to bring people up to speed, colleagues, and then for one reason or another, during an election season, they leave and a new person comes in their seat, and then you have to kind of start from scratch. For those of you who haven't been following the Ethics Committee makeup, it really changed a lot. There were a lot of new appointees to the committee this last year, I think, on the Republican side of the House committee in particular. There was only one change in those of us that were from the Democratic side on that House committee. But on the Republican side, there was only one member that had been on the committee the previous 2 years. So I think part of the challenge that I had in running my campaign finance reform bill, as well as my Ethics Commission advisory opinion bill, had a lot to do with kind of starting from scratch and educating my new colleagues on the committee as to the benefits and the support that having those two pieces of legislation moving forward would provide to the legislature and to the public. So I'm hoping to continue to move that forward. We aren't meeting this interim like we did last year. I don't know the reason why. It may possibly have to do with the fact that as a third committee assignment, it's difficult for individuals to attend to their other committee assignment as well as the Ethics Committee when it was meeting with regularity over the interim last year.
Right.
And particularly problematic for our senators because they are really split in numerous directions by the number of committee assignments that they have over the interim. So a number of the Ethics Committee bills that we were looking at over this general session were assigned to the Government Operations Political Subdivisions Committee for consideration and for study this interim.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. My guest is Democratic State Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck. And Representative, I've heard, I think, from both Republicans and Democrats that this session was really different in that, you know, with the last election, there were certainly more probably members who identified with the Tea Party, and that the Republicans, you know, not only did they gain seats, but also got more conservative. Did you feel that?
It was very interesting. And what I will say is, you couldn't peg it necessarily. An example that I thought was very intriguing, and even most recently on the veto override session, but you know, this first example that I'll give you kind of shows how you can't really peg how the so-called Tea Party contingency might possibly vote. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with a bill that Representative Sandstrom ran regarding allowing hotel owners to allow firearms to be taken into their hotel rooms. Mm-hmm. and saying that they couldn't prohibit someone who carries a firearm to bring their firearms into their room. And on the floor, the Democrats didn't even have to speak to that bill, because what it became is for lack of a better word, a fight or a debate between those who were for individual rights to carry firearms versus those who were supporting private property rights. So a lot of the Tea Party, so-called Tea Party affiliated representatives, were arguing the property rights argument versus the firearm rights argument. Right. And actually, between those who are more conservative and Tea Party affiliated and the Democrats, we were able to defeat that bill. So that was one example. The veto override a bill, the 4-10 work week bill, right, that came up, that was another one that I found intriguing in terms of the debate, because you had a couple of more Tea Party affiliated representatives that were saying that we were treading on very shaky ground in terms of the balance of powers between the two branches, which is why I voted against the bill. I had some real concerns about that. So mm-hmm. It's really interesting where you see some of the alliances and the arguments dovetailing from maybe the more civil libertarian side into the Tea Party libertarian role.
And speaking of that special session still, most lawmakers have said, you know, this was not personal. This was not to weaken Governor Herbert politically. But it seems that some anonymous lawmakers have been quoted in the newspaper saying just the opposite. There were political motives behind this. As somebody who was there, what was your sense of that?
And it's interesting that you bring that up, because oftentimes when I've been asked to give a synopsis of my perspective of this last session, I have actually brought up what I saw was a number of efforts to kind of reassert legislative power over the executive branch. Mm-hmm. And so for me, and maybe I was just hypersensitive to it, but that I felt that there was a concerted effort to assert legislative authority in many cases. And there was this tension definitely there. Was it necessarily to poke, you know, Governor Herbert in the eye? I don't think so. I think it was more of, trying to differentiate the roles of the legislative branch versus the executive branch and who had which power. For example, the bill that we passed that would give partial legislative authority in terms of appointment of the director of healthcare financing in the Department of Health, where now that has to be supported by consent of the Senate. Mm-hmm. That's one example. Another example was an effort to combine departments together and consolidate them.
Right.
Those are just two examples, coupled with what happened with the veto override session and the 410s bill, that to me made me feel very uncomfortable about going down that direction, just specifically for that balance of power issue. I just was wondering why it was so necessary and why now. You know, a lot of those bills that we – well, the two bills that we – that the legislature – I won't say we because I didn't vote for them. The ones that were the bills that were overridden, the vetoes that were overridden – you know, I just don't know why there was no – time wasn't of the essence in regards to those bills. I believe that that's something we could have dealt with next session. And so then I wonder why the urgency? Why did we have to do that so overtly?
And in the final few minutes we have left, Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck, let's talk about the GRAMA issue for certain. The GRAMA working group is meeting right now. We're, of course, talking about open records and the bill that lawmakers passed, HB 497, and later repealed to restrict open records access. Where do you see this going from here? Do you think it will be acceptable to most lawmakers to say, let's leave it how it is because we like how it is right now, or no?
You know, they're having some interesting discussions. I've been trying to tune into the working group. Haven't listened to everything. I know that the subgroups that have been assigned to look at different facets of proposed changes are still working on their final recommendations. What often happens, and what I like to see happen when you bring all the stakeholders together, is you come up with some kind of hybrid solution. Whether that will satisfy some of my colleagues, I don't know. I like it because I prefer incremental change, mm-hmm. because then you can test to see how it works. And I know that there are discussions regarding retaining the legislative intent of the original grandma law, which was extricated with HB 477. And I'm glad to see that being explored, because that was an issue that was of great import to me. I believe that legislative intent is very important to keep in law. It helps the courts and it helps the State Records Committee navigate some very close calls in terms of deciding which way a decision needs to go. And that's just one example of what can happen if you take some time to make those changes. You know, it's hard for me to say, because I know that a number of my colleagues feel very adamantly about changing the law to a great extent. Otherwise, they wouldn't have ran that bill. But I'm happy for the discussion. I'm happy for the opening of dialogue that it presented. For example, this morning we got an email from the Society of Professional Journalists inviting us to the next meeting of the State Records Committee. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very heartening to me. And I'm hoping that my colleagues, I'm planning to go, and I'm hoping my colleagues will see this as an opportunity to understand more about how the Records Committee is doing its work. I was really baffled when I asked Representative Dougal on the floor if they'd even been consulted in the drafting of this bill, and there was just kind of no. And so it just, that bothered me. So I'm happy for the dialogue that is open. I think that there will be some hybrid solutions presented, and we'll just see what they think of them.
And finally, let me ask you a question that is tricky politically. During this session, the House and the Senate, Democrats make up about a quarter of each body. But it's interesting to note that there were key issues where you did not present a unified front, grandma being one of them, one of the most vociferous, one of the lawmakers who argued most vociferously in favor of HB 477 was a Democrat, and some Democrats also voted to override the governor's veto as well. So there's clearly a split on some issues, and I'm not saying anyone thinks that you should all vote in unanimity, but do you find yourself frustrated sometimes that, you know, with a small group of Democrats that you have, that there are some splits there?
Not necessarily. You know, as I mentioned when I gave you that example of what happened with the Tea Party representatives and ourselves, it's just hard to say where alliances are and where people feel they can best represent their constituents. And there might be some similarities between myself and a very strongly held of social libertarian, you know, who is a Tea Partier. And so, you know, I think we need to look more at issue alliances. For the most part, we as a caucus try to stick together, but part and parcel of being Democrats is allowing ourselves not to be kind of held by a heavy hand to go one way or another, and to feel that we can vote more the conscience of our constituency, maybe necessarily than a caucus vote. And I appreciate that. I think that we are each accountable to our constituents first. And, I think that's one reason why I enjoy being in the party that I do.
Our guest has been State Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck, Salt Lake City Democrat who represents the Avenues and downtown Salt Lake. Representative, we appreciate your time.
Thanks again.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW.